supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Philadelphia has officially cleared out what was left of two homeless encampments in the city's Kensington section. I'm Dave Heller, and this is Newsworks Tonight. The cleanup marks the end of a pilot program to close some of the camps where hundreds of people with addictions have been living and then move them into housing and treatment. For WHYY, Joel Wolfram reports that outreach workers and protesters were on the scene this morning as the city tried to relocate those who remained.
There were still several tents under the Tulip Street Bridge in the final minutes before the deadline for the campers to leave. It's one of the two encampments the city cleared today. Swarms of outreach workers were trying to get the stragglers out before police and sanitation trucks came through to clean up. Thomas McGrath was busy breaking down his tent. He says he's been living here for about 2 weeks.
I've been off the street for years, and I'm a heroin addict, and I got caught up, you know, again. Lost my place to live, so I ended up out here, you know. So now they say it's time to go, and there's nothing I can do about it.
McGrath says he'll just pitch his tent somewhere else, maybe under the I-95 overpass nearby. He says he's not ready for treatment yet, and not going to a shelter because all the new beds the city opened in the neighborhood filled up.
But if there was one in this neighborhood, I'd be in it, believe me, because I could go to work from a shelter. I could work from a shelter or something like that, you know? It's hard to work from the street, though.
He was offered a bed in a shelter west of Broad Street, but doesn't want to go that far away. The city expanded shelter capacity during the pilot program and says it's lowering barriers to treatment for people coming from the camps. At the other encampment the city cleared, on Kensington Avenue, demonstrators protested the city's efforts to remove the campers. Vanessa Baker says the city isn't following through on its promises of making more treatment and housing available.
We want shelter beds and treatment beds for everybody that wants them. These are our neighbors, and this is a living hell out here, and nobody should live like this.
A shouting match erupted at one point between protesters and neighborhood residents who support clearing out the camps.
Shelters ain't going to take them because they want to get drugged up. There's rules and regulations at the shelter.
Neighbors have been pressing the city for months to get homeless drug users off the streets. The city says it has to balance the needs of neighbors with the interests of those living at the camps. Officials say so far 125 people accepted treatment or housing during the pilot program. They say they'll evaluate the program before tackling two other encampments in the neighborhood. For WHYY, Joel Wolfram.
Pressure on Philadelphia City Council to vote on a Just Cause eviction protection bill will be ratcheted up at a scheduled rally tomorrow organized by Philadelphia Tenants Union. Joining me to lay out the case is Tenants Union supporter Peter Moskowitz, author of a book entitled How to Kill a City, Gentrification, Inequality, and the Fight for the Neighborhood. Peter, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks for having me.
The Tenants Union has been a primary driver behind this so-called Good Cause bill. What are the terms of the bill?
So the bill is pretty straightforward. Basically, what it says is if a landlord wants to evict someone, they have to have a good reason, a good cause to do so. And those causes can range from things like, you know, destroying the property or destroying things within it, being a repeated nuisance to your neighbors, or, of course, not paying your rent or not paying your rent on time repeatedly. So landlords would still have the right to evict essentially any bad tenant that they wanted, but it would give a little bit more of a formal process to evictions.
How does the bill change the status quo?
Well, the status quo now is landlords can just say you're evicted. They don't have to give a reason at all. You're out on the street, you know, within the next 30 days if they want. This just lists specific reasons that they have to evict you. And if they do evict you randomly or without one of these causes, the bill would essentially say now you have recourse to say they've violated this law and you can go to court.
How does the eviction rate in Philadelphia compare to that of other comparable cities?
Evictions are, to put it bluntly, at crisis levels in Philadelphia right now. In some neighborhoods, up to 15% of people in any given year are being evicted. So that's 15% of an entire neighborhood being kicked out of their houses every year. They're higher on average in the entire city than in other comparable cities across the country. But it really is a neighborhood by neighborhood issue in these rapidly gentrifying areas and in really poor areas where people don't have stable jobs, stable incomes. Eviction is reaching these tremendous levels that you're seeing today.
So with that, let's bring gentrification into the conversation. First, a definition.
Gentrification, I think, means a lot of things to a lot of people. To me, it means cities becoming less and less supportive of poor and working class folks and more supportive of the rich and of growing capital, essentially. So cities become places where real estate investment becomes the major tool of wealth in the city, and that puts a lot of pressure on lower class folks.
Your book focuses primarily on four cities: New York, New Orleans, San Francisco, and Detroit. Each has its own story to tell, but are there commonalities that would also apply to, say, Philadelphia?
Sure. So in my view, gentrification can't happen without the government's participation, the city government's participation in it. In each of those four cases that you mentioned and that I cover in the book, before real estate developers descended on cities, before they bought up lots of real estate, governments essentially welcomed them in. They gave them tax breaks to buy up buildings. They slashed public fundings on things like public schools and public transit and used that money to attract development and new business. And whatever you think of that strategy, what I show in each of those four cities is that regardless of how the city is doing economically, there are all these huge consequences to that strategy. So Philadelphia is not Detroit or New Orleans or San Francisco, but you can see the same thing happening here where there's a constant budget tightening on certain sectors of the city and then a welcoming of investment on the other side. So you saw this with the recent bid for Amazon's second headquarters.
There's a telling line in your book: gentrification couldn't happen without something to gentrify.
I mean, that's how this works. A lot of the times, real estate investors are going into disinvested neighborhoods that have been kind of cut off from government help for a long time, from investment for a long time, and snatching up cheap real estate. And, it doesn't have to happen in these kind of smoke-filled rooms. It's not people purposely saying, we want to disinvest in this neighborhood and then gentrify it. It just makes economic sense to take the poorest neighborhoods where you can buy real estate for cheapest and turn them into the most expensive neighborhoods.
In the course of your work, did you find cities where there are good cause eviction measures in place?
The entire state of New Jersey is probably the best example of this. They have good cause on their books. I forget if it's called good cause or just cause there, but it's the same bill essentially. And it does exactly what Philadelphia's bill would do. It just says there has to be a specific reason for tenants to be evicted. And I like pointing to New Jersey because it kind of refutes the point that real estate investors like to make, like, oh, we won't be able to make any money or the industry will collapse if you pass this bill. New Jersey is a very real estate friendly place. And so it hasn't collapsed the real estate market, but it's given tenants a few more protections in court, especially.
Thank you so much for shedding light on this issue on NewsWorks Tonight.
Yeah, thank you.
Peter Moskowitz, author of How to Kill a City: Gentrification, Inequality, and the Fight for the Neighborhood. Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney visited Puerto Rico last week for the first time since Hurricane Maria devastated the island last fall. Philadelphia has the second largest population of Puerto Ricans on the mainland, and more than 900 Puerto Rican families fled to Philadelphia after the storm. Catalina Jaramillo of WHYY's Plan Philly talked with the mayor about his experience there and the lessons learned.
Mayor Jim Kenney came back from Puerto Rico impressed by his residents' resiliency and strength, but shaken by the lack of action from the federal government.
I found it very unsettling to be there because they're United States citizens. We should be helping them. We're not. And things, the power grid's not back up. Two-thirds of the island is still have intermittent power and lights. It's just really a shame.
Kenny toured around San Juan with Mayor Carmen Yulín Cruz, visiting different neighborhoods and after-school programs. Electric power is the biggest problem, he says. Buildings still have blue tarps on their roofs, and people are struggling. But at the same time, he says, vegetation is starting to grow back, and tourism is recovering, bringing back a feeling of normalcy. Kenny says San Juan's mayor is doing everything she can to prepare her city for this year's hurricane season, but they don't have the tools or the infrastructure needed to face another big storm like Maria. And people are still emotionally traumatized.
People will start talking to you and then drift off into back into the hurricane mode and start, you can see their minds are wandering.
Kenny says Philadelphia is better prepared to host Puerto Rican evacuees now. But he makes clear emergency management for the island is a federal responsibility, not the city's.
We're trying to do our best to take care of everybody, and we'll take care of those who are refugees if it happens again. But, you know, the federal government has the wherewithal to do better, much better than they've done, and they refuse to do it. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that people are not, they're not white people.
Kenny says Philadelphia will be helping San Juan in the coming months, sharing knowledge about water management and solar energy. Catalina Jaramillo, WHYY News.
Across the country, the dairy industry has been struggling. Consumers are buying less liquid milk, and many farmers are having a tough time turning a profit. When a national distributor recently announced it was ending contracts with more than 100 dairy farms nationwide, that included 42 in Pennsylvania. Keystone Crossroads' Min Shin went to Lebanon County to meet with farmers looking for ways to stay in business.
Stretches of farmland spread along South Lincoln Avenue in Lebanon, Pennsylvania. These days you will notice yard signs planted across the area with bright orange letters that read, "Save our local dairy farms." Alicia Risser owns one of those dairy farms.
And then this is our heifer barn. They're aged about 11 months through 16 months is what we house here.
Risser and her husband run a dairy farm in Lebanon County, milking 80 cows. They started a contract with Swiss Premium 17 years ago, a brand distributed by Dean Foods. In those days, Risser says business was good. In recent years, things got harder. Fewer people are drinking milk, and competition among producers has grown increasingly harsh. This March, the Rissers received a termination notice, saying their contract with Dean Foods would end by June. The company says the decrease in sales left them no option. Risser says the decision came as a surprise and left farmers very little time to react.
If you lose your milk market, there is just not options out there.
Risser and her husband considered selling their farm. But by the beginning of April, Harrisburg Dairies announced that it would pick up 9 of the farms, including the Rissers.
We're nervous about the direction the dairy industry is going to go, but this immediate crisis, you know, to have that burden lifted off our shoulders is tremendous.
These things don't always work out. According to the Center for Dairy Excellence, Pennsylvania lost more than 800 dairy farms since 2010. Having worked on farms from a young age, Risser says she understands the volatility of the industry.
The ability for a farm to make a profit is always going to be a challenge. It would kind of come and go in highs and lows, where the lows would not last real long. And what we're seeing currently is just a long stretch of low prices.
Across the country, the price farmers get for milk has been dropping. It's now about 3/4 of what it was in 2011. At the same time, Risser says it's costing farmers more and more to make milk. And the USDA says dairy farmers are getting 87 cents for every dollar spent to produce.
I think most farms are not making enough money per month to pay their bills. So for every month that we're in business, we are losing money.
Since prices are decreasing, farmers turn to increasing production to try to make up losses. But the more supply that floods the market, the cheaper the milk becomes. Jim Goodman, a Wisconsin farmer, is president of the National Family Farm Coalition.
So it's kind of a vicious cycle that higher production kind of encourages even more production, and the farmers get nowhere.
In the U.S., state and federal government have a role in determining milk prices. Goodman says government could do more to help family farmers.
In the United States, it seems that there's never been any question as to how much production is too much.
To find remedy for this crisis, Goodman's group wrote an open letter to members of Congress and the USDA, asking for an immediate raise in milk prices nationwide.
We need some kind of emergency relief right now because farmers are losing their farms. They can't pay their bills, and this impacts the whole structure of rural communities.
But there are skeptics of this idea. Dave Schwartz is the assistant director of Penn State Extension, a research center that helps farmers.
From a human side, that sounds very compassionate and important. And we do care very much about the people who operate these farms. Unfortunately, when the government intercedes in a part of the economy like that, it often has maybe unforeseen effects.
He says even if some farms go out of business, it's a natural result of marketplace economies. But it's a very tender subject. A study from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention found that farmers have the highest rate of suicide in the United States. Back in Lebanon County, the researchers feel lucky that they have a new deal. About 4 dozen dairy farms in the area are still working with Dean Foods, but researchers says at least 2 are planning to sell their cows.
There's a lot of farms, good farmers, that are having to sell out right now, and it's our thoughts are with them. It's tough.
I'm Min Shen, Keystone Crossroads.
During this time of Ramadan, representing the holiest month in the Islamic calendar, a new children's book from a Philadelphia author focuses on a mother-daughter bond told through the eyes of a young girl's delight in wearing a kimar, traditional headdress. Joining me in conversation is Mighty Writers Program Director Jamila Tompkins Bigelow, author of Mommy's Kimar. Jamila, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you for having me.
We'll get to the book, but describe your role as program director at Mighty Writers.
I manage the programs that happen at the South Philadelphia site. We offer writing programs for children. And basically, I will develop curriculum for those programs. I'll get volunteers trained. Basically, we're teaching kids how to write.
And so you've turned it around and you've written a children's book. What inspired you to go in that direction?
So I guess I became aware of the lack of books for African-American kids and African-American Muslim kids, or representing those kids anyway. I just didn't see any representations for my own kids of children who were like them, who had similar backgrounds to them. And I felt like I could write those kinds of stories. And I started having ideas about it and learning more about children's book writing. And I loved it. And when I fell in love with it, I just couldn't stop.
This book is delightfully told, again, through the eyes of a young girl, say 4 or 5 years old, and her delight in observing her mother's dress and then, as a flight of fancy, emulating it herself. It's illustrated as well. And talk about your work collaborating with the illustrator, how that came about.
So Simon & Schuster, once they accepted my manuscript for publication, the art director worked with the editor to kind of come up with a vision, and they picked an illustrator they thought could bring that forth. And I'm just so happy that Ebony Glenn, the illustrator, that she illustrated this book, because the work is perfect for this book.
To those not of the faith, some are perhaps more familiar with the term hijab. Explain the difference, if there is one.
Right. So the difference between hijab and kimar, they are the Islamic headscarf. Both words have a basis in the Quran. Hijab is used more by South Asian and Arab people, and African-American Muslims, they also use that word, too. However, kimar is also traditionally used a lot with African-American Muslims. And because I wanted to center African-American Muslims in this book, I use the word kimar.
Though this book, as you describe it, is intended for those of the faith, it's also a general interest book. And it's so wonderful. You have a page about grandma, who's not of the faith, but the point is inclusivity is really what matters.
I feel like I wrote in 2 different levels. I wanted it to be a book where a Black American Muslim would look at it and be like, oh my God, somebody wrote about this, and like really recognize themselves in that. And I wanted it to also be a book where other people are reading it and going, wow, I learned something new.
You recently penned an opinion piece in the Philadelphia Daily News called I'm Growing Tired of Explaining My Muslim Beliefs. Is it the fatigue of having to explain, defend, justify?
It's sort of the always being put on the defense, always having to explain the basics. So I sort of push back on that idea that I have to defend it. But I have been in lots of situations where in the first few minutes of meeting someone, they're asking me to explain why I wear a kimar, and it's just uncomfortable and weird because I don't know this person. And I think that was sort of the point that I was trying to make, is like, you know, always othering people and putting them on the defense and making them explain their choices. When I first meet someone, I don't ask them about why they made a certain choice in their clothing, right? And I just think that that's not something that you should do to Muslims either.
The article that you penned, the opinion piece, isn't just expressing that frustration slash fatigue. It's also offering ways to cut through that. And why don't you review some of what you advocated.
One thing that I wanted to point out is that for people who are not of the dominant culture, of the mainstream culture, we spend a lot of time trying to learn the nuances, understanding things about the dominant culture. You know, I know a lot about Christianity, for example. I know a lot about the holidays. We do this work, and that's considered a norm. If we didn't know these things, then, you know, we'd lose some social currency, right? On the other hand, though, people who are from the dominant culture should also reach out and learn about other cultures as well, right? They should do some of the work. That should be interesting to them because we're all people, right? We all have interesting cultural, religious, whatever it is. Like, we have different backgrounds, and it's worth knowing. And, you know, cultivate relationships with people who are not from your same religion or ethnicity or culture. But, you know, if you cultivate those relationships, you learn a lot.
Thank you for taking the time to join us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you.
Jamila Tompkins-Bigelow, author of Mommy's Kemar. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.